Hello, this is Jill Burridge, welcoming you to the summer 2025 issue of our quarterly magazine programme, which is produced by Mark. This being one of the 4 weeks of the year when our news editors actually get a week off. We begin with an interview in which Rob talks to actor and director Jenny Lee, who's appeared in many popular TV dramas, about her career from the earliest days to the most recent on stage, on television and on radio.
My guest in the studio today is Jenny Lee, who has a very interesting career, both on stage and on the screen as an actor. Jenny, welcome.
Thank you.
I've said that you acted on the stage and on the screen, and you are still acting on both.
Yes. When I started, it was quite a long time ago, and television was not the easiest thing to go straight into. Stage was the thing. The stage was what you're trained for. Nowadays, they train the youngsters. They've got a television studio. They do television technique, everything. We didn't have that, but we had the classics, and we had the moderns, and we had everything. But it was all about stage technique, and you could have a good career on stage.
Did you actually go to a college where you trained?
Yes, I went to Glasgow College of Music and Dramatic Art, as it used to be called. It's now called the Conservatoire, Scottish Conservatoire. I also did some singing. I also went to Glasgow University and did a degree in what they call dramatic art or whatever. So I kind of have always been a bit of an intellectual with regard to the work I'm doing.
Sometimes you think, well, it's better not to know too much. You just want to get into the character.
That's true. You can over-intellectualise, there's no doubt. But one of the great fascinations for me and for many actors now, particularly, is having a good background in the plays that you're working on, in the people that have been written about, in the writers, as well as it's like running parallel. You do two things. You study the character and get into the character, but on the other hand, understanding the playwright and where they've come from is very interesting. I mean, I've recently done a Martin McDonagh play. He directed and wrote the Three Billboards.
The film, yes.
He did that. The Irish playwrights at the moment are very prominent, actually. And knowing a little bit about him, and then when you get into it, it's about the rhythms and it's about all sorts of other things. And knowing a little about his background also helps. But you forget about all that and you get on and you play the character as well. But all that's fascinating. All what we call detective work's great fun.
Therefore, there are three people involved in this. There's the actor, there's the director who also does all this research and work, and then you're saying that you actually draw from the writer or the history or the context or the surroundings, whatever else it is.
It's always interesting. Not everybody's bothered. It depends what kind of an actor you are. But if you're looking at Benedict Cumberbatch or Fiona Shaw or whoever, whereas Judi Dench would probably say, no, just give me the script. You know, I don't know, but she does tend to say, I just read the script.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. You went to the university first, did you?
No, I went to drama college.
Drama college first.
And I did a course, a degree.
And that's where you learned the stagecraft.
I learned it for 3 years at Glasgow, yeah. I was at drama college and I had as a sideline, I went and did a diploma in dramatic arts, I think it was called, at the same time. I kind of balanced out the one with the other.
So that's where you get this idea of the two sides of the actor from. The ability to get into the character, but also the ability to know a little bit more about what's going on. Where's this character coming from? Where in the brain of the writer has this person emerged from?
Yeah, absolutely. I find it fascinating.
And do you think that comes across to the audience that you really understand where you are?
Not necessarily at all. And I think if you're too intellectual about it, then it would be terribly boring. But it doesn't want it to get in the way of what you're doing, because it's an emotional thing, acting. It's an instant response to what somebody says to you and you say something back. You don't think, oh, the playwright would like me to do this, that or the other, you know, unless it's a particularly unusual piece. Avant-garde, 1960s, I'm trying to think, Ionesco, whatever, you know, some of the really unusual playwrights that came along.
Well, you talked about the Irish earlier, and I was looking at your long list of successes, and one of them you were in Happy Days by Beckett.
Yes.
Now, I imagine that means you were buried up to your waist in sand for the first act and up to your neck in the second, is that right?
Yes, yes. We took it to the Edinburgh Festival as well. I can't remember how we managed to get round the problem of it, you know, because, you know, the turnaround at the Edinburgh Festival was 15 minutes. You can't actually get a load of sand on stage in a great hurry and take it away again.
Now, that was quite a physically demanding performance, I assume, because it's quite difficult to be buried in sand, and certainly in the second half when you're up to your neck and you're trying to see what the other character is doing, because he's crawling behind and
that's
in front of
right.
him.
I was doing it in Wimbledon in the theatre that I was running at the time called Attic in a studio, and I just met my current husband. This is the first time he was going to come and see me act, and I thought, right, okay. I'd been in his radio play and he was expressing great interest and all that. And I thought, we'll see. So I said, right, come and see me in Happy Days. If he survived that, I thought we might have a future.
You mentioned Wimbledon. Now, this is where you were acting as well as directing. It was a...
I don't know. Somebody said, shall we start a theatre? And we were on the fifth floor of Wimbledon Theatre in the rehearsal room up there. So we called it Attic because it was the highest. People really had to start 10 minutes before the performance in order to get to their seats. They had to allow an extra 10 minutes to get up the stairs. Yes, it was a musician, myself, and another actor called Colin Haig. We started with Alan Bennett's Green Forms and a visit from Miss Prothero. I think they're written as radio or television. Never been done on stage because we always did firsts, you know, premieres of one kind or another. And Johnny Gould, the musician, asked Alan Bennett personally if we could open with that, and he said yes. So that was the beginning.
And what made you go into this concept of a theatre group? I mean, effectively, what you were doing was creating a group of people who were going to stay together, or was it a company that people came in and out of?
Well, we ran it, though. I mean, we decided on what we were going to do, and to start with, I was just marketing. That's all I was doing to start with. I was working at Bristol Old Vic at the time, actually. I remember trying to do the marketing for Bristol Old Vic, which was very peculiar. It was a wing and a prayer. Absolute wing and a prayer. We got a few benches and 15 lights. You know, it's the usual story. And then it moved down to what was the old ballroom. And I did a kind of Joan of Arc to the Wimbledon Council and said, we would like to do theatre in this space. And they said, you can have it for 10 weeks in the year. That was the beginning. And now it's a fully established theatre space. But it was a terrific thing to do. It's the autonomy of it. It's the excitement of actually deciding, instead of somebody saying, would you like to come along and play this small part? But, of course, we're choosing you, but there are other people coming along as well. So you might not, you know, might not get it and all that. You say, no, actually, the play I really want to do is this one. And I'm going to do Rosmer's Home, as I did at one point and directed it. And I got a translation that had never been done before. And, you know, this is going to be my version. So it gives you a terrific feeling of being part of the whole theatre world rather than a tiny cog in it. I think that has appealed to a lot of people over the years. Some people stay in the directing and in the producing very successfully. A lot of actors have moved on into that. But for me, acting has always been the thing I was born to do. So,
how do you know you were born to do it?
I just know it. How you know you were born to be an artist or a musician? It's the same thing, and it has its own agony to go with it because it's an interpretive art. You're not creating yourself. You've got to have something to interpret. So somebody has to ask you to interpret it. Whereas if you're a writer, it doesn't matter if nobody ever buys your books because you can still write it and express yourself. Same with paintings. A musician can always play somewhere, anywhere. An actor needs an audience, as we have here.
As a child, you must have performed. You must have had a sense of what was going on from a very early age.
I was born into a non-theatrical family. My father sang round the piano, a lovely voice. My mother played. So that was sort of typical of the period. My sister and brother were both musicians, and my mother played the piano and they did a trio. And I decided I didn't want to be that. I would far rather do what they called elocution lessons, partly because as I was always ignored when they were playing, and I just thought, well, I'm not joining them.
You were the youngest one.
It was the youngest one. So I went off and did elocution lessons instead. Just somebody gave me a puppet theatre, I did puppets, I did the lights, I did everything. It just was something that was part of what I wanted. And I couldn't wait to go to drama college. I was meant to go to university and study science or something. And I you know, at the age of 16, that was it for me. I was away.
That caused problems with your musical but otherwise non-theatrical family?
No, my mum was on her own by that time. I mean, but I just went through from Edinburgh to Glasgow, and she knew that was what I wanted to do. And they let me in at that age.
Is that unusual? Even then, was it?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I did an audition where I actually faced upstage and did the whole speech to the back wall, because that's where my couch was when I practiced in my sitting room. So I don't know how on earth I got in. Dear God.
Now, you've taken that talent, first of all, onto the stage, into theatre, but you also moved into television. How long ago did you move into television for the first time? Because you've done quite a lot of stuff on the small screen.
Oh, yes, but when I came to London, which wasn't too long before I was down here, because the work in Scotland, there wasn't a great deal. Of course, you then went up for television parts and all that in the series and other things.
Do you have an agent?
Yes, I got an agent and started doing whatever came along. I did one extraordinary piece called Ape and Essence, which was an Aldous Huxley script. It was a play for today, all about the end of the world. And it's based on his novel called Ape and Essence, apparently. It was an extraordinary, big, futuristic piece. I did a series on Colette, and I was in that, and Dr. Finney's Casebook, of course, and various other things.
Television is very different, presumably, for an actor from the stage, because on the stage, you've got into the character, and you're there, although you may come on and off stage during the evening. Effectively, your character is continuing through that.
Yeah.
Television can be quite different, can't it? You're there, and then you sat somewhere for several hours, or the following day, or you come back and do another bit. I mean, how does it work?
That's more like film, really. I mean, film is very, yes, you sit around for hours and hours. It's true, you sit around for hours and hours, and then they need you, and you've got to be able to do it that moment.
Yeah. Television is a bit more relaxed on that than that.
Television is like that too, to a degree. And the main thing, as I recently read Michael Caine's book, and he, all the way through, which fascinated me, insists, learn your lines, know your lines backwards. Now, he was a film actor, really. With the stage, you get your 3 weeks or your 2 weeks or even your 1 week. When we did weekly rep, which I did actually get the tail end of, you were actually learning, putting on a play each week. So you were actually trying to rehearse and learn and all that. But television, like this recent one I've been doing, which is Hollyoaks, you have to go absolutely to the lines learnt, and then it's plotted, you know, laid out how you're going to move or which positions you're going to be in, and then they run through the lines and then they film it.
When you start a stage play, you've rehearsed it, let's say, for 2 weeks. It's hopefully, if you're not in rep, you've done 2 weeks of rehearsal. And in that time, you've got to know the other actors quite well.
Yeah.
You not necessarily know them at the beginning, but you've got to know them. And you've all brought to it your thoughts, having learnt the lines. And then you find they don't necessarily gel with each other. So you rethink some of it. And that's the director is trying to pull all that together. Television, you turn up having learnt your lines. Do you know the other characters?
People just be. On television, they be. And they're usually cast because they're very close to, and the stuff is immediate, and the dialogue tends to be sparser. Something like Killing Eve is a little bit more involved. The Crown would be another one, but The Crown, when you look at it, people don't have very many lines. They have to create their entire character, and then the line just sits on top, if you like. So you've got to look at the person and believe that they are who they are, and then they only have two or three things to say. It's a different way of working, if you like. You've just got to be kind of relaxed and inside who you are, and you don't tend to travel too far from yourself. And that's kind of the secret of, and when you do, then you need to do it very subtly. It depends how good the writing is. You tend to see the function of your character within a television very clearly. Whereas on stage, it can have huge kind of, I wouldn't say metaphysical exactly, but it depends whether if it's a classic or something, then you're actually looking at something that's got depth and subtext and all the rest of it. Television usually doesn't have subtext to speak of. Ken Loach chooses people who are not necessarily trained at all, but they're exactly right for what he wants. And their naturalism is wonderful, usually. And we as actors need to learn a lot from that. But then radio, you can express.
Have you done much radio?
Yeah, a lot of radio. It was originally on The Archers. I played Valerie Woolley on The Archers. Had the first ever affair on The Archers, and they're doing it all the time now, I don't know. She was married to Jack Woolley, and she was a bit of a lass. No, that's great when you've got a long-running piece, because then you can develop and you can find your own characteristics, and the writers start writing your characteristics that you're developing into your character, as well as the plot lines that they have as a series as a whole. But then you get something and they begin to use foibles or...
And do you find this happens in the television? I mean, you mentioned Hollyoaks.
That was very recently. I mean, unusually, and I didn't get to wear high heels either. No, I was playing a terrible granny, a hateful granny on it. And I was amazed because most of the cast were, I think, 30 years younger than I was. So I was delighted to be there. It was great. And I had such fun. But by gum, you had to know your lines. I mean, you know, really had to know them backwards.
Is that because the technology is first, as it were, that the actors are there to participate in a process which is driven by the technology, and they need to produce in a certain amount of time and certain sorts of budgets? Therefore, the actors have just got to be ready to go.
I don't know if it's technology exactly. It is the amount of material that they need to produce in a short space of time in order to make the whole thing viable. And they're all the same EastEnders. I've done EastEnders, and they tend to be the same. Casualty and Holby City are not as pressured, but Doctors is very pressured, and they'll just sort of do your rehearsing, and they'll say, oh, that's fine, we'll use that as a take. And you say, but that was a rehearsal. It's the first time we did it. And they say, no, that's fine.
Is that hard for an actor, thinking, but I haven't delivered my best?
Well, no, you just go along with it. And sometimes it's spontaneity is all part and parcel. You see on film, they say, don't learn your lines too well. Another technique is just learn them before you do them so that they just come as if they've... Naturalism is all. You know, this feeling that you're actually a genuine person just saying what comes into your head. Very important.
But very different from the stage again. If you're in a classical play on stage, which, as you say, has got so much hidden meaning, if you like, that you're trying to bring out as well as their characters and their relationships with each other, that demands so much of you. And yet I have a sense that perhaps television doesn't demand very much of you.
Your screen time is usually less, but it depends what it is, what you're doing. The challenge is to play a small part and make it appear as rounded and have as much depth as a bigger part. That's always a challenge. It's a challenge on stage as well, because you're not given enough information. They're not interested in your character, the writer. You're there as a function. To do, say hello and open the door or whatever it happens to be. And it's a different challenge from playing a big part. Big parts are great. Ralph Richardson once said that acting's like shooting clay pigeons. He said, when you've got a big part, you've got lots of clay pigeons. It doesn't matter if you miss two. When you've got a small part, oh, if you miss one.
Did you ever act with Ralph Richardson?
I didn't. No, I didn't. I didn't. But I admired him tremendously. Yes, him and Gielgud, I thought they were great.
Yes.
But he had a tremendous, wicked, wicked sense of humour. It's lovely. But each time, the thing that matters is that it's your thoughts in your head that you're expressing, and the words are is the way you're doing it. So both are the same. Television, film, I'm all three. Radio's different because, you know, you're given a script and you don't learn it. But the spontaneity of actually the thought comes before you speak. In every case. And then what you speak is what the thoughts produce. So that's how it works.
What's the most difficult play you've ever done?
Happy Days was a challenge because at one point I missed out a speech. I jumped and I was able to put it back in later. Nobody knew the difference.
This is the luck.
Beckett is tricky.
Yes.
Has to be said. And
the audience would have come to that. There would have been those who knew Beckett before and therefore they were okay with the sort of things that he was up to. And there were those that would have been completely mystified by it. Why is this woman buried up in this pile of sand?
I know.
Muttering on about something we can't understand.
I know.
So it's quite difficult. But how do you cope? Do you sense that the audience understands in a play like that? That's quite difficult to do, not just physically, but because it's a difficult text.
Well, they wouldn't be there if they weren't interested in seeing it. And it has a lightness and it's quite comedic in its own way. Beckett has got that. He gets a bad reputation. But you're there to entertain. That's the main thing. And you're given these wonderful words to do it with. But the repetition is sometimes quite tough. But no, you have to decide what it is you're doing. It's like looking at a painting that's surreal or listening to a piece of music that doesn't conform. It has the same quality. And as such, it's a release and it's fascinating. Because all the words, they're all colours and they're all pictures that you're painting. So they're not a straight narrative line. It's all jumbled up and thrown about. And in a way, it's liberating. If you do an Agatha Christie, it's A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
I was going to say which are the easiest ones to do, and it's presumably that sort of
I tell you, Agatha Christie is terrible to learn because it isn't written very well. I shouldn't be so rude because it's done all over the country, but you're playing usually a stereotype. And if a play is badly written, that's when it's difficult to learn because it has no rhythm. It doesn't make sense what they've said and things. So those are the difficult ones.
Some of the classics are very complex.
I'm fascinated by Shakespeare. I love it. And I've directed more than I've been in. Almost, I think I played Lady M and I've played various ones, Nerissa and various people. But I did get the opportunity of directing a lot of them. And the language, just wonderful. Just brilliant. And the concept is big. The man's thinking in very big terms, but also minute terms too. Very personal and small terms as well. The musicians in Romeo and Juliet. The below stairs stuff that sometimes get missed out. When they come, they think they've come to play for a wedding. It turns out to be a funeral and they don't know what they're going to do and whether they're going to get anything to eat. You know, there's stuff like this, which is so ordinary that he writes about. I just think he's great, but he has huge concepts as well.
What are you going to do next?
At the moment, I'm up for an advert, and you would not believe this advert might take me to the Bahamas and Kiev, and I'll be away for 11 days.
That is the story of many actors' lives, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, an awful lot of time waiting for the phone to ring.
Yes, but you have to have another life running alongside, otherwise you'll be in trouble. And that's where we all belong. We're reflecting life as it is lived, you know. So if you don't live in it and you live in a bubble, then you're not going to be so good at it.
Thank you very much, Jenny.
You're very welcome.
Next from our Talking Bookshelf series, Helen Piku and I chatted about four audiobooks. They're The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher by Hilary Mantel, Sidney James and the Problems of Evil by James Runtse, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry by Rachel Joyce, and Emma by Alexander McCall Smith. Hello, this is Jill Burridge, and we're doing our occasional look at audiobooks that are available from the local library. And I'm joined today by Helen Peku, who's from Hertfordshire Library Services. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
The first two books that you've chosen today are really short stories. Well, one's slightly longer stories, but the first one that you've chosen is Hilary Mantel's The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher.
Yes, that's right. There are 10 short stories in this set, and they're all very different.
She's, of course, a prize-winning author for her books about Thomas Cromwell, Bring Up the Bodies, Wolf Hall, etc., which have been televised recently. But she's written a lot apart from Wolf Hall and Thomas Cromwell. And these are a collection of stories that I think she's sort of written over the years, aren't they?
I think so, yes. They've all appeared in various journals and newspaper articles and that sort of thing, and were put together as a collection last year. They were published.
The first one and the last one being The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher, which caused, just by its title, quite a bit of controversy. They're both about intruders, aren't they?
That's right, yes. And quite similar the way they start off, with a lady on her own in a house. Somebody knocks on the door, she opens the door. But of course, they take a different direction. And the first one is actually based very much on Hilary's own experiences when she herself lived in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. And it's almost what happened to her, I think.
It has a sort of claustrophobic feel about it, doesn't it? Because she is very much kept to the flat where they live. Her husband works. She's living on the in a flat on a compound, and she really can't go out. She's not well, she's on a lot of medication, and the way she describes the heat and the silence of her flat is quite chilling, really, isn't it?
Yes, it must be very oppressive to live like that. Women obviously are very restricted, even foreign women. They can't really go out uncovered. There's no cinemas in Saudi Arabia. There's no sort of form of entertainment. So she has to sort of make her own entertainment with a few people who live in the complex. And also she's on medication, which is affecting her sort of view of everything there as well.
Mm. And then one day, the story is based around the fact that she allows a Pakistan businessman into the flat to make a phone call. And the story develops from there.
And she wonders if she's done the right thing, because this chap keeps coming back. But he actually turns out to be fairly friendly, but she's not sure if she's done the right thing.
And he persists in visiting her, and she becomes a bit, annoyed, actually, with him returning.
She does. And he brings his family as well, two little children, and he's got an American wife. But then that doesn't seem to be going well. So I think she's quite happy when he doesn't come back again.
It's quite bizarre in a way, the story, isn't it? And several of the other stories, I felt I was waiting for something to happen. And it didn't really happen in some of them. They're quite disjointed episodes in a way, aren't they?
If you're expecting a twist at the end of every story, then you'll be disappointed. But that's not to say that they're not enjoyable to listen to, because her powers of observation, the way she looks at human nature, that's what these stories are about, looking at interactions between people. And the other stories have elements of infidelity in them. There's one about anorexia, all different different themes, and she's just really observing people's nature.
Let's have a little taster. You've chosen an extract from one story, which is called Offences Against the Person. Do you want to just set the scene for us?
Well, all of these stories in the collection are in the first person. And so in this one, it's a teenage girl who's going to work for her father during the summer holidays, and he's a lawyer, a solicitor, and he is actually having an affair with his secretary. It's set in the 70s, and so this extract is just describing this secretary.
Her name was Nicolette Bland, and she was my father's mistress. I'm going back to the early 70s. It's a long time now since he was subject to urges of the flesh. She looked like a Nicolette, dainty, poised, hair short and artfully curling, dark, liquid, slightly slanting eyes. She was honey-coloured, as if she'd had a package holiday, and she looked rested and seldom not smiling. I put her at 26. I was 17 and filling in the summer before university as a junior clerk in my father's chambers. Devilling, he called it. I never knew why. I used to watch her type, clip, clip, little darting movements of her pearlescent nails. They say women never learn to type, I offered. They were just beginning to say it, round 1972.
So that's an extract from Offences Against the Person. I particularly liked the story, which was obviously drawn from Hilary Mantel's own experiences, where as an author she went to talk to a literary group and she had to travel, and they were supposedly putting her up somewhere nice. But when she arrived, the bed and breakfast where she was given accommodation was absolutely revolting, and her descriptions made me sort of feel I wanted to be physically ill. Actually, they were so powerful.
That's one of her strengths, the fact that she can just sort of make these observations and describe, and you feel that you're there.
And she then, in that final story, which is the title of the whole book, The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher, she sort of uses that, because inadvertently she's expecting a plumber to come to her flat, and instead this Irish terrorist arrives who wants to take a pot shot at Margaret Thatcher. And Hilary Mantel sort of uses that to her own end to give her views about Margaret Thatcher, doesn't she?
She does, and in fact she's on record as hating Margaret Thatcher and doesn't sort of want to cover that up at all. But this story is set actually in real time that happened, where Margaret Thatcher was going to an eye clinic or was just leaving after an operation. So it could have happened, and you know, you sort of read through to the end and you'll see it could have happened. It's very clever, just the interaction between the lady in the house and this sort of IRA terrorist.
They are very clever stories, actually, aren't they? And her style of writing is really gripping, I think. So that's The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher, and it's by Hilary Mantel. So continuing with shorter stories, we're going on now to James Runcie and his third set of stories about Sidney Chambers, who is a vicar, actually, but he has inclinations towards investigating crime, doesn't he?
He ends up falling into these sort of crimes, helping out, because they're set in the 60s and sort of 50s, these stories, and he obviously was a key part of the community. So, you know, he hears things and people confess things to him that, you know, they perhaps wouldn't to other people. So he's in a good position.
Sidney Chambers actually is the vicar of Grantchester, which is just a little village outside Cambridge. So that's the setting for all the stories. And that setting is rather good in itself, isn't it? You get a feel for Cambridge, the sort of flat terrain around the city and the historical side of all the, you know, colleges and his circumstances, etc.
Yes, you do. And he goes into Cambridge quite a bit, and in the stories, you know, describing the streets. So if anyone knows Cambridge, you'll be able to sort of visualise that.
This new book is called Sidney Chambers and the Problems of Evil. But in the first two books, he's formed a sort of
friendship with Keating, who is a detective, and they meet every week, I think, in the pub, don't they?
They do, yeah. They have a sort of weekly gathering in the local pub to play backgammon, and that's where, you know, they catch up on the events that have been going on in all the villages.
And that's how your extract that we're going to hear now actually starts.
After they'd got in the first of their regulation 2 pints and sat down by the window, he complained that his grey hairs were edging remorselessly upwards. His belt had loosened not one but 2 notches in the last few years, and that his need for reading glasses made him look like a civil servant. "And not a very well-dressed one either," he sighed. "That's true," Sydney said absent-mindedly as he laid out the backgammon board. "Are you agreeing I'm scruffy, Sydney? Your clothes are well lived in." "Well, that's because the only people who get new clothes on my salary are the children. Not that I see that much of them. The demands of the job. It never stops, you know." Sydney told his friend about the 2 doves that they'd discovered on his doorstep and was alarmed when Keating began to take a particular interest. He assumed that he would have been accused of being overly suspicious, but in fact the reverse was the case. The inspector was all ears.
For those people who have heard of the first 2 series, I think Sydney's circumstances are slightly changed by the time we get to this new one in Sydney Chambers and the Problems of Evil. He's actually got married.
Yes, he has a German wife called Hildegard. And given that this wasn't that long after the Second World War, it is actually described in the book that how his relationship with his wife is seen as very positive with the enemy almost. She is a very sort of calming influence on him and sort of tries to bring him back down to earth when he gets a bit carried away with all this sort of amateur sleuthing.
Yes, his amateur sleuthing. They're quite sort of gentle stories, aren't they, in a way? I know they deal with crime, but they're not violent or gory.
Not at all, no. They're quite sort of, yeah, as you say, gentle, easy to listen to. Almost Agatha Christie-like in some respects, of the, just because of the pace of life then. And everything seems easily resolved. So,
but in the first one, he has to deal with vicars that are being popped off, basically.
Yeah, there's a serial killer on the loose. So that's the first story. And he sort of has these powers of deduction, and he can sort of try and work out and question things that maybe the inspector hasn't considered.
They are quite mannered in a way, and you do wonder how Keating misses all the clues that Sydney Chambers manages to pick up, don't you?
And he kind of relies on Sydney in some respects, and every time he embroils him in another mystery, and his wife, Hildegard, "Oh, no, can't you stop doing this?" But he feels compelled, I think.
And what are the other story themes that he develops?
One of them is a famous painting disappears from an art gallery. A very attractive French girl walks into this gallery and tries to distract everybody by taking her coat off and all her clothes. And then this painting disappears. So that starts off the hunt for that painting. Another one is that he becomes a sort of minor film star, and there's a film being made in the village, and he's cast as a vicar. So you'd think that he'd be able to do that. And what seems like an accidental death during the filming, a drowning, turns out to be perhaps not quite as it first seems. And then the last story is that he investigates the theft of a child from a hospital.
These reminded me of Midsummer Murders in a way, that's the sort of tone of the stories, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. It's that sort of village setting, that very community spirit, and just somebody who's obviously, you know, shouldn't really be involved in solving crimes, manages to wheedle his way in and get to know everybody and find out the answers.
Of course, James Runcie, the author, is local to St Albans.
Yes, of course. His father was Robert Runcie, and in fact, he said that he has loosely based Sydney Chambers on his father.
Oh, really?
Yes. So I don't know what Robert Runcie would have made of it, but he said he would have been quite amused.
I think he probably would have been. So that's James Runcie's 3rd in the series of Sydney Chambers books, and it's now an audio book, and the title is Sydney Chambers and the Problems of Evil.
And earlier on, we were talking about Hilary Mantel's collection of short stories, The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher. So, Helen, going on to longer novels now, one that's been very, very popular and is on audiobooks now is Rachel Joyce's title, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. I think when this first appeared, when it was first published, it was long-listed for the Booker Prize, wasn't it? But it seemed to gather momentum, this book, one of those ones that word of mouth did great things for.
It's a very clever and interesting story and something a little bit different.
Tell us what the sort of theme of it is. It's about Harold Fry, obviously. He's just retired.
Yes, recently retired brewery salesman. And he receives a short letter from a former colleague called Queenie Hennessy. And she's in a hospice at the other end of the country, in Berwick-upon-Tweed. And he lives in Devon. And she's got terminal cancer. So he writes a short reply to her and just says to his wife, Maureen, he was just going to post the letter. And he keeps walking and decides he'll go to the next post box. And this goes on. And then he eventually takes up this remarkable pilgrimage.
At the start of his walk, he actually calls into the petrol station. And I think that's the extract that you've chosen, if you want to just set the scene for us.
Yes, he gets hungry, so he decides to go into the petrol station to get some supplies. And he gets chatting to a sales assistant there. She tells him something that really sticks with him and makes him make his decision.
You have to believe, that's what I think. It's not about medicine and all that stuff. You have to believe a person can get better. There's so much in the human mind we don't understand, but you see, if you have faith, you can do anything. Harold gazed at the girl in awe. He didn't know how it had happened, but she seemed to be standing in a pool of light, as if the sun had moved, and her hair and skin shone with luminous clarity. Maybe he was staring too hard, because she gave a shrug and chewed her lower lip. Am I talking crap?
Gosh, no, not at all. It's very interesting. I'm afraid religion is not something I ever quite got the hang of.
I don't mean, like, religious. I mean trusting what you don't know and going for it, believing you can make a difference.
She twined a strand of hair round her finger. Harold felt he had never come across such simple certainty, and in such a young person. She made it sound obvious.
So that extract comes from nearly at the beginning of The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. His journey then goes on. You have to slightly abandon credibility, don't you? Because I kept thinking, hold on, he hasn't got enough money. He hasn't got any changes of clothes. He hasn't got, you know.
Yeah.
And I had to, in the end, I just had to say, I'll have to forget that.
Yes, the fact that he's like a 65-year-old man, he's only got a pair of yachting shoes to begin with, nothing else. I think he's left his phone, everything at home, because he wasn't intending to walk. And he does actually get given things as he goes on, and he gets this entourage of people. Then he decides to sort of abandon it all and just go very simple again. So yes, there is an element of it that you think, how could this happen? But it's the spirit, I think, mind over matter, and the fact that he's got a mission.
This is 600 miles, this journey.
I know, I don't know. I mean, it takes him 3 months. I mean, it's pretty good going.
And meanwhile, his wife is sitting at home.
She's at home at a loss what's going on. Actually, what's quite nice about that part of the story is that you find out really the problems that are behind it all. They're not happy as a couple. They have a son, David, and you find out what happens there. She begins to see Harold in a different light as well. So her personality and her character change as well.
And he has quite an impact on the people he meets along the way too, doesn't he?
He almost becomes a guru. Everybody starts following him. They have their own reason for doing the walk. Obviously, his is solely he wants to get to see Queenie, hoping that she knows that he's doing this and that she will rally and stay alive. But all these other people follow him. So that part of the story becomes quite different, I suppose. And once they're all gone, it gets back to just him again, which is good.
It's sort of an allegory, isn't it, about a time to reflect and rethink and reevaluate your life.
He does a lot of thinking. I mean, that's also how the narrative moves on, that we find out as he wanders along, he's thinking about his past, what could he have done, why did things work out this way? And you learn about his own upbringing as well. He didn't have a happy childhood. That's quite a good way of the author bringing in all these other parts of the story.
Rachel Joyce, the author, I was reading before she started writing this novel, she had been writing radio plays. And I think she's written what she's called the companion book to The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, which is the story told from Queenie's side as well.
No, I haven't read that one, but that would be interesting, yeah, to see, because you do find out a bit about why Queenie was so important to Harold, even though they haven't worked together or even had any contact for a very long time. So, yeah, that would be interesting.
And this was one of those books that just took off. It was in the bestsellers for a long time then, wasn't it?
Yeah, sometimes stories like this just spark the imagination. It's a bit like The 100-Year Man Who Jumped Out of the Window. It seems to be a lot of stories about older people recently doing amazing things that capture the imagination.
Quite inspirational. Then you've chosen what seems on the surface to be a classic, but it's actually a rewriting of a classic. So this is a project that has been launched, the Austen Project. And the idea is that six contemporary well-known novelists will undertake to retell the novels that Jane Austen wrote, which is a daring thing to do for any novelist, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, obviously, they're just such treasured classics. I'm not quite sure, you know, whose idea this project was, but they're all best-selling authors, the others being Joanna Trollope, Val McDermid, Curtis Sittenfeld. So far, I think there are still a couple more. They haven't got anybody to write. And obviously, Alexander McCall Smith is a best-selling author in his own right.
He's done the number one detective agency and quite a few other things.
Scotland Street, yes, loads.
Yes, he's very well known. And he has retold Emma.
Yes, he has. And I should mention that each author has to stick to the novel's existing plot and the characters, but they are free to make some changes. So don't expect any great rewriting because they have to have the main story. So basically what he's done is modernised it.
And he's set it in a contemporary setting.
Yes, it's modern day Norfolk. You've still got Emma and her family who are well-to-do. And you've got all the other sort of people in the village or the town who are just normal working class people as well.
So Jane Austen set out when she was writing Emma to create a character who, I have to say, wasn't particularly appealing to readers. You don't fall in love with Emma. She's quite a tricky madam, isn't she?
Yes.
And Alexander McCall Smith in his retelling has done the same.
She's quite a sort of stuck-up young lady. She's recently finished university. She's done an art degree or something like that. She wants to set up her own interior design business. And she does think she knows better than everybody else. So she's quite bossy.
You've chosen an extract from near the beginning, actually, where Mr. Woodhouse is interviewing Miss Taylor because she might become Emma's governess, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So when Emma and her sister were young, he decided he needed a governess. And Miss Taylor's my favourite character, actually, out of all of them in this particular version. She's quite good-natured and she doesn't suffer fools gladly, as you'll find out from this. She's the one who's going to be boss. So he puts an ad in the Lady and she answers it and comes along to be interviewed.
It did not take Mr. Woodhouse long to confirm his earlier suspicion that Anne Taylor would be exactly the right person for the job. "You seem to be entirely suitable," he said, a bare hour after her arrival. She seemed surprised by what he had said, and for a moment Mr. Woodhouse wondered whether he had unwittingly committed some solecism. He had been careful to call her Miss Taylor rather than Anne, even if that sounded rather formal, so it could not be that. Had he said anything else, then, to which she might have taken exception? "I have yet to indicate whether I shall accept," Miss Taylor said quietly. "One does not assume, surely, that the person whom one is interviewing wants the position until one's asked her." "But my dear Miss Taylor," exclaimed Mr. Woodhouse, "how crassly insensitive of me. I was about to raise that very issue with you, and..." "There is no need to resort to spin, Mr. Woodhouse."
What was it about the style of Alexander McCall's writing in this retelling of Emma that particularly appealed to you?
It's very sort of gentle writing, easy to listen to. There was nothing too taxing, and he throws in some little jokes and that sort of things. Yeah, very light, easy read.
Were you a particular fan of the Jane Austen version?
Who can better Jane Austen, really? But it was interesting to see how he would manage to set it in a modern day. And there are some twists that he can sort of change slightly to adapt to our thinking.
So can you just tell us about the way Alexander McCall Smith has rewritten, in a way? He's used the village setting, which he's often used in his own books anyway, and he's done that again here with Emma.
Yes, it's a village in Norfolk again, so a small community where everybody seems to know everybody else, even in this day. And yeah, he does that a lot with his other novels.
Okay, so an interesting listen there. And just to recap on the title, this is Alexander McCall Smith's retelling of Emma, the original story, of course, being by Jane Austen. And we were also talking earlier on about Rachel Joyce's novel, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, which is now also available as an audiobook. And earlier on, we were talking about James Runce's Sydney Chambers and the Problems of Evil, and Hilary Mantel's collection of short stories, The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher. Helen Pekku, thank you very much for joining us and giving us your pick of the best audiobooks that are available at the moment. Now our selection of national radio programmes that you might like to listen to this coming week.
Hello, I'm David, and here are some radio highlights for this coming week that I hope you will enjoy listening to in the days ahead. We'll start with Saturday the 28th of June, or as Radio 3 calls it, Saty Day. Throughout the day between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m, Radio 3 marks the centenary of the death of the Normandy-born composer Eric Satie. It starts with Saturday Morning, presented by Tom Service, including comedian Alistair McGowan, who delves into the composer's flamboyant and sometimes odd writing and music. For those with a different taste in music, BBC presents All Day Glastonbury throughout the weekend. You can hear it on BBC Six Music and on Radio 2 from 8 a.m. and on Radio 1 at 1 p.m. The scatterbrained Scarecrow of Oz, a sequel by Alfred Bradley to The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, is Radio Times Treat of the Week, and you can listen to it on Radio 4 Extra at 6 a.m, repeated at 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Archive on 4 brings us John Simpson's Dictators. The journalist recalls the dictators he has encountered over the decades, exploring how they came to power and how they eventually lost it. And ahead of Wimbledon, Classic FM brings you Next Level with Dan TDM, a showcase of sport-themed video games, including many well-known theme tunes. Next Level with Dan TDM is on Classic FM at 9 p.m. And then for Sunday, the 29th of June, there are two Sunday services on offer today. Radio 4 presents Matins from Queen's College, Oxford at 8:10 in the morning, and Radio 3 brings you Choral Evensong from St Martin's in the Fields in London at 3 p.m. Radio 3's Weekend of Eric Satie continues at 7:15 p.m. with Sunday feature Eric Satie, the Minimalist Muse, followed at 11:30 p.m. by Unclassified, when Elizabeth Alker presents three new works inspired by Eric Satie. That's all on Radio 3. Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs is Sir Gregory Doran, former artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company. Desert Island Discs is on Radio 4 at 10 a.m, repeated on Friday at 9 a.m. The afternoon drama on Radio 4 is The Girls of Slender Means, written by Muriel Spark, the author of The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. It tells the story of a group of young women thrown together by circumstance, living in a single-sex hostel in post-war London. The Girls of Slender Means is on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. And at 7:45 p.m. on Radio 4, Just One Thing with Michael Mosley explores how volunteer work can lower cholesterol and help people live longer. And now for some programmes that are broadcast each weekday at the same time. Unearthing the Past, Sarah Dunant explores the life, letters and times of Isabella d'Este, Marchioness of Mantua, one of the leading women of the Italian Renaissance. Unearthing the Past is on Radio 4 each day at 11:45 a.m. Composer of the Week on Radio 3 is, surprise, surprise, none other than Eric Satie. And you can listen to his works at 4 p.m. each afternoon on Radio 3. Between the Ears Miniatures, five sessions where audio makers bring you features inspired by the weather. Between the Ears is on Radio 3 each evening at 9:45 p.m. Book at Bedtime this week is Summer by Edith Wharton and is on Radio 4 each evening at 10:45 p.m. Now programmes for Monday the 30th of June. Radio 4 presents Starmer's Stormy Year, recalling the most dramatic events of Keir Starmer's turbulent year as Labour Prime Minister. Starmer's Stormy Year is on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. For fans of the pop group Oasis, BBC Six Music presents an afternoon of the band. Oasis at the BBC is at midday, followed by Oasis Live at Nebworth at 1 p.m. and Oasis What's the Story at 2 p.m, all on BBC Six Music. You can listen to historic episodes of Steptoe and Son on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert is by the BBC Concert Orchestra, including music by Sibelius, Henrik Sandas and Johan Ullen. Radio 3 in Concert is at 7:30 p.m. And on Tuesday, the 1st of July, The Three Transformations of Virginia Woolf. In this first part of three, Fiona Shaw examines how Virginia Woolf's work resonates with readers today. The Three Transformations of Virginia Woolf is on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. And you can listen to Vintage Comedy today with an episode of The Goon Show on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 p.m. and at 6:30. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley follows the trail of French Victorian art thief Amélie de Kuyper, who made a habit of moving into furnished rooms before vanishing with various items. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. With the Women's Euro 25 football tournament coming up, Maisie Adams' The Beautiful Game presents a guide and predictions for the summer tournament on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert this evening at 7:30 p.m. is a performance of Verdi's Requiem, recorded at King's College, Cambridge, earlier this month. And then on Wednesday, the 2nd of July, The Coming Storm at Hay, a discussion recorded live at the Hay Festival with Gabrielle Gatehouse examining people and events that have shaped US politics in recent years. The Coming Storm at Hay is on Radio 4 at 9:30 this morning. Vintage comedy today is Hancock's Half Hour from 1957 on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. The Artificial Human. Experts explore issues around artificial intelligence, how it is being used on our streets, and whether AI dreams in the same way as humans do. The Artificial Human is on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. Radio 3 in concert this evening is a performance of Mahler's Third Symphony, Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. And then Radio 4 Extra has the first of two dramatised instalments of Richard Adams' iconic novel Watership Down. The first episode is today at 3 p.m. and 9 p.m, followed by the second and final one tomorrow at the same times, both on Radio 4 Extra. Also at 9 p.m. this evening on Radio 4, Walt Disney, A Life in Films. Mel Giedroyc examines the life of Walt Disney through his most famous works. This first episode delves into the creation of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, his first feature film. Walt Disney, A Life in Films is on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. Thursday the 3rd of July. In This Cultural Life, John Wilson talks to Anselm Kiefer about his life and inspirations. Kiefer was born in Germany and has lived and worked in France since the 1990s. This Cultural Life is on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. Radio 3 in concert this evening features works by Brahms and Stravinsky and is on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Today's vintage comedy is an episode from 1999 of Bristow, based on the comic strip of the same name. Bristow is on Radio 4 Extra at midday. And the second and final episode of the dramatised reading of Watership Down is on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. When It Hits the Fan takes you into the world of crisis management and spin doctors, as they take a look at recent PR disasters, finding out how it all began to go wrong. When It Hits the Fan is on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. And then Friday, the 4th of July. 50 Years Around the Clock, a 2005 programme tracing the origins of Bill Haley and the Comets' 1954 rock and roll milestone song, Rock Around the Clock. 50 Years Around the Clock is on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 this morning. Heart and Soul on Radio 4 at 11:30 a.m. meets young women in Egypt, using their voices to amplify their faith, drawing inspiration from the long tradition of female Quran reciters in the country. Heart and Soul, Radio 4 at 11:30 a.m. Rare Earth, The Aftermath of the Bomb, an examination of how society's relationship with nuclear fusion has changed since the dropping of the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Rare Earth is on Radio 4, just after midday. Screenshot Music Festivals at 7:15 on Radio 4 explores music festivals on screen, including Woodstock and Glastonbury. Friday night is Music Night at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3, brings you a showcase of Broadway and West End musicals. And that's all for this week's radio selection. I do hope you enjoy the programmes.
Next, we bring you one of Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly Nature Notes for the Hearts Advertiser. One small step for our grassroots community. It might just be me, but sometimes I feel as if I have seen too much nature, too much wildlife, too many amazing wonders of the natural world. When I say this, I'm not talking about the nature I have experienced firsthand, the nature I've actually heard, seen, smelt, touched, and yes, even tasted. I am talking about the images of nature seen during hours of exquisite wildlife documentaries, within the glossy pages of premium wildlife magazines, and countless other exceptional photos, capturing creatures at their most lovely, their most beautiful, and dazzling us with their finery and finesse. The message is clear. Nature is extraordinary, beautiful in the extreme, complex, at times perplexing, but always surprising and infinite. But it is this word extraordinary that bothers me. Is the subtle message of all these fine productions that nature is extraordinary, outside and beyond our ordinary everyday lives? And what's worse is, the more I watch, the more ordinary this extraordinary becomes. The once exotic unknown has been revealed up close and personal, again and again, thanks to our camera technology. It's as if the bride has bared all, leaving no surprises or mystery for her wedding night. And yet in reality, nature makes us wait, makes us go on a journey of discovery, allowing us only glimpses at a time. It is this process of persevering, of waiting, of uncovering that makes wildlife watching so rewarding and ultimately deeply personal. Of course, I'm not against the incredible wildlife programs we enjoy on TV. They serve an important purpose. But what we see is served on a plate that we never had to wait or work for. It is a meal consumed for which we were never hungry. Almost 2 years ago to the day, I wrote about the closure of Butterfly World in St Albans. At the time, there was a thin thread of hope that it might reopen as Butterfly World 2. But 2 years on, this is not to be. It appears Butterfly World was a meal for which we were not hungry, or at least not enough to see it through some rocky financial times. Of course, the closure was a sad moment, for it was hoped that Butterfly World would be an oasis for butterflies, and indeed, in its short lifespan, had already become just that for the small blue butterfly. Absent from Hertfordshire for nearly 5 years, this little butterfly is now enjoying not just one, but two broods in a season, thanks to the ideal habitat created at Butterfly World. But I can't help wondering that had Butterfly World gone ahead in all its glory, it, like those beautiful wildlife documentaries, might have served us up a feast that dulled us to the nature all around us. Writing 2 years ago, I suggested that the story of Butterfly World provided a good illustration of the journey we must all go on when it comes to conserving and enjoying our natural world. I wrote that beyond the large organisation, there must instead be a grassroots movement, one that has the ownership of the local community, expressing its own care for its own local nature. It was therefore extremely gratifying and exciting to meet with Malcolm Hull, chair of the charity Hearts and Middlesex Butterfly Conservation, at Greenwood Park in St Albans, where exactly this has been happening. With the support of St Stephen Parish Council and funding from the Lottery Heritage Fund, a purpose-built chalk bank has been dug out and is being seeded and planted with chalk-loving plants that it is hoped will provide the perfect habitat for butterflies. A particular target species is the small blue butterfly, which will hopefully colonise the area. Cleverly designed to provide warmer microclimates and planted with the small blue's favourite food plant, kidney vetch. While this is a relatively small-scale project compared to Butterfly World, it has pulled together local volunteers and organisations including the local primary school. It is a truly grassroots project that could be replicated across Hertfordshire, even on a miniature scale in our own gardens. Butterfly World may be closed, but it lives on in community action like this, and I was equally heartened to hear that the action group Butterfly World 2 has reinvented itself as a charity promoting the planting of wildflower meadows. To date, with the support of local authorities and other organisations, they have planted three new meadows in St Albans, Hemel Hempstead and Watford. So why not get involved in one of these projects, or maybe even consider starting a similar project at a green space near you? You never know, you might just develop a hunger for our local wildlife, and one that is far more satisfying than any TV documentary or pristine photo.
And now Stephen De Silva, our guide to the cathedral and its history, explores the time between the 8th and 14th centuries when a monastery and abbey were at the heart of the town.
Stephen De Silva is back in the studio. I'm delighted to welcome you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Stephen is a guide at the Cathedral, St. Albans Cathedral, a teacher in his spare time, long-time interest in history, and obviously knows everything there is to know about it. So I thought, having looked at the story of Alban and the role of the cathedral in Magna Carta, the pre-Magna Carta meeting, and various other things that we looked at, including the later rebuilding and so on, and who's buried where, and all sorts of other things that we've done, we want to look at that bit in between. After all, it was a monastery. At one stage. Well, most of us don't quite know what it would have been like because not much of it is left today. So where did all this start? I mean, obviously it was a critical site for anybody to select, but who chose to come there? Why?
Well, we know that there were pilgrims visiting the Church of St. Alban right from the really early days. We then enter that period of English history called the Dark Ages, where there isn't a lot of written detail. But there are hints that King Offa of Mercia, in the year 793, comes to St. Albans and builds a monastery, founds a monastery. But rather tantalizingly, some of the references say there were monks and nuns already living there. So in this period of the Dark Ages, had this holy place already been attracting people who wanted to live together in community to spend their lives in prayer? The trouble with the details, the charter that says that King Offa founded the monastery, is that it's a much later document, and it's difficult to say with absolute certainty that he did so. I was listening to a historian recently who said perfectly likely that he did so, because King Offa needed to set himself up as a European king, and a good way of being a European king is to have patronage, to have a saint who is associated with you, and Alban would have been a great choice for King Offa to be associated with. He was quite a rival of some of the Kentish kingdoms, and Canterbury, of course, had St. Augustine and all the traditions down there. So Offa probably did adopt St. Alban and St. Albans as one of his personal projects.
Let's just set the timing context here, because we're talking about what century we're now in.
So tradition says 793 is the year that Offa founds the Benedictine Monastery of St. Alban. But as I say, he takes something that's there and reshapes it into a Benedictine monastery. Benedict was the great European founder of monasticism, a great scholarly man. Benedictine monasteries were associated with scholarship, with teaching, with the production of fine manuscripts in their later stages.
By the time that we're talking about here, which may or may not probably was Offa, pilgrimages were going on already. There were pilgrims were coming to the site?
It looks like, again, reconstructing things like archaeology and coins, it looks like there's a relatively steady flow of pilgrims, which thins out in the 500s and 600s, and then picks up again in the 700s and 800s onwards, which fits again the dates that were given for roughly when this monastery is refounded. So there may have been a thin little trickle of pilgrims in the 500s and 600s. So pilgrims kept coming, but the re-establishment of a monastery, in other words, having a team of people who could care for the shrine of St. Alban, house Alban's bones in something beautiful that could be visited and honoured, that seems to have been re-energized around about the year 800.
Presumably they had to find the bones first.
They did indeed. I guess the tradition of where they were probably would have been kept alive as an oral tradition. We're not sure. And there was always the debate about, you know, relics. Were the relics that were housed in the Middle Ages the things that were there originally? I think with Alban, we stand a better chance than with many of saying there might have been a surviving memory. This ruined church that the steady trickle of pilgrims visited, probably the site of the burial of Alban would have been one of the remembered and honoured spots, even if it was a ruin.
Because it was on a hill.
And highly remembered after the destruction of the monasteries, somewhere like Walsingham in Norfolk, which has no shrine for several hundred years. Nevertheless, we know people visited Walsingham. They went to it. There was a nostalgia for the old days. You know, even Shakespeare talks about the bare ruined choirs where monks once sang. So I think I can accept the idea that there was a memory of where Alban's house was, where Alban's home in terms of his physical burial was. I think it may have survived in people's memories. Certainly there's a reinvention, if that's the right expression, of Alban in the around about 800.
Villages like St. Michael's were, as we see them today, if there's anything there was very little there.
Very little there. So the parish churches of Michael, Stephen and Peter are all founded by the monastery, by one of the Saxon abbots, who also founds the market in St. Albans, which is carried on to this day. So this Saxon period, you can see a flourishing, really, of a community, a confident community growing and building. And these three little churches become almost like little pilgrim churches where people did the final stage of their journey to the St. Albans Shrine. Those three churches have just produced a modern-day pilgrims leaflet, encouraging modern pilgrims to visit one of those parish churches and make their journey to St. Albans Shrine.
So the town itself wasn't particularly big at the time.
No, we're looking at a very small community, and really even up to the point of the Reformation, in a sense, the abbey is the great focus of the town. There is a town obviously thriving outside the abbey gates, but the abbey is the raison d'etre for St. Albans.
So if there was a religious place, whether it's a church or a ruin or the beginnings of a monastery, then what does Offer, or whoever it is maybe building this, what does he have to build?
He has to build a church for them, a Saxon church, which we have some fragments of, but no real idea of how big it was. He has to build things like dormitories to house them. There would have been rudimentary medical facilities and some kind of infirmary. There will have been practical things like kitchens. There probably would have been the very early stages of a farm to supply food for the monks living there. So in effect, he builds a small town. And that's what these big monasteries were. They were complete enclosed communities with all of their needs attended to. I mean, the monks at St. Albans eventually did go out and mingle very much in the town of St. Albans, but they could be self-sufficient within the walls of the monastery.
And were they covering what we would say the land around the abbey now?
Yes, if you stand outside the abbey now, the cathedral now, and you have your back to the cathedral looking down the hill towards Verulamium Park, that whole hillside was covered in buildings. These were the abbey buildings. They stretched as far as the great gateway, which does still survive outside St. Albans School, right down to the bottom of the hill. There was an enclosed wall enclosing all of that area. Today, if you go on, and you've probably seen the pictures on a nice dry summer, take an aerial photograph, you can see the outlines of these buildings going down the hillside. Those buildings were a crucial part of what the monastery was. So in the Middle Ages, when people talked about the monastery of St. Albans, they weren't necessarily thinking about the church. You're really talking about the community of St. Albans, the community of monks.
And it wasn't just monks, because there were nuns as well.
Yes, there were. The earliest records indicate there were female religious houses as well, but they were separated out very early in the Saxon period, and the female religious nuns seem to have been dispersed into smaller houses. There doesn't appear to have been one large central female religious house. So in a way, typical of perhaps male history, the abbey itself, the male monastic house, becomes the dominant feature of St. Albans.
Because one of the features of the area is there's a river down the bottom of the valley.
Yes, yes.
And that's it was very important then.
Yes, navigable. We're told that things could be offloaded at a wharf down at the bottom and brought
up. Which presumably
up.
Is where the pub, the Fighting Dogs.
In that area, yes. Yeah. Some of the things in the cathedral are really interesting. The tower ceiling has Baltic oak in it. How did oak from the Baltic get to St. Albans? People have speculated. Was it ballast and ships coming in? You know, there's all kinds of debate about how these things reached the cathedral.
Now, that river ran from way out up in towards Bedfordshire, as it were.
Yes, up into the Chilterns somewhere. Yes.
There were habitations. I mean, where Kingsbury is now, was it a small town?
Yes, there was. And it claimed royal patronage. And it was a real thorn in the flesh of the Abbot of St. Albans, because the Abbot of St. Albans is the real landowner. And so, in a way, all the tenants around and about should look to the Abbot as their lord and master. And, of course, Kingsbury claimed to be a little royal free borough, and it was a thorn in the flesh to the abbey and the abbots, and eventually Kingsbury is razed to the ground, and the annoying citizens, the abbots are very rude about them. If you read the deeds of the abbots of St. Albans, wonderful book, which has just been completely translated into English, they regard the Kingsbury lot as mere vagabonds, really, you know, causing theft and murder, and they're accused of all sorts of things. I mean, you know,
stealing fish from the fish ponds.
The
fish went past Kingsbury before it got to the...
They would have probably leapt the fences and got into the abbey fish ponds and stolen there. They would have hunted on abbey land at night, poaching in effect, but also generally were disrespectful to the monastery. I suspect they didn't tug their forelocks enough for the abbots of St. Albans.
This is something that then goes on right through history, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It leads to all kinds of things in the 1380s, where not just Kingsbury, but the whole of St. Albans, the whole of England, stops tugging their forelocks.
The authors that give us the picture of this, who are they? I know of one name, Matthew Paris.
Yes.
When was he writing?
So he's writing in the 1200s.
Right, looking back at all of this.
I've just mentioned this book called The Deeds of the Abbots of St. Albans. The abbey, like many great monastic houses, had what we call historians or chroniclers, and they kept a chronicle of the history. Now, The Deeds of the Abbots is a very substantial document, abbot by abbot, telling us what they did, passing a judgment on them. Were they good or bad? Most of them get the seal of approval of people like Matthew Paris. Matthew is a chronicler not only of the abbey, he writes other chronicles too. He writes chronicles about England and Europe. So he's a really important historical record for this period.
Was he a monk himself?
He was a monk at St. Albans. Highly well thought of, advisor to the king. When the king visits the abbey, he often wants to talk to Matthew. Matthew's regarded as a very important person. And there are others, Walsingham and others, all kinds of people who were in the tradition of chroniclers. This chronicle of the deeds of the abbots, it starts to peter off towards the 1400s. But even then, you still have powerful abbots and their stories being written down. John of Wethamsted in the middle of the 1400s, perhaps the last really big, powerful abbot of St. Albans. But even the ones who come after him still have some influence. And all the way along, the abbey chroniclers in their scriptorium, the little part of the abbey where the scripts are literally written, are chronicling and recording and saying, and in this abbot's time, this was built and that happened. It's not history as we know it today. It's not objective. Abbots are judged on all kinds of things. Usually, were they good or bad? And the city and the town is judged on whether it was obedient to the abbey or not. So, you know, somebody like the citizens of Kingsbury that we were just talking about, well, they're terrible because they don't show due respect. Same thing happens at several periods in the history.
So it's a mixture of who's in power, who's controlling the situation, plus what they've heard, because it wasn't all written down. They weren't taking a lot of documents out of Wikipedia and putting them together.
No. Matthew was always fascinated. Matthew Paris is always fascinated when visitors come. Remember, the monastic houses of Europe sent people from house to house. So the idea of just English monks only living in an English abbey or Spanish monks living in a Spanish abbey, that's nonsense. They travelled from place to place. So several nationalities may be represented. They had the common languages of Latin and others, which would have allowed them to talk to each other. And Matthew, we know that whenever somebody visits the abbey, Matthew, I'm sure, pinned them down and said, so what have you heard in your journey here? It's taken you 6 months to get here from wherever. Tell me what you've heard. And we get all lovely snippets of history, some of which are verifiable, some of which completely aren't. Wonderfully gossipy sometimes as well.
Benedictines were not a silent order or anything
no, they
specific.
Kept, they kept a greater silence, like all the monasteries, and much of the day was in silence. But they didn't have a complete vow of silence, no, because they were working together, as I say, producing manuscripts. So in the 1100s and 1200s, St. Albans Abbey is a great source of beautiful manuscripts. Some of the most beautiful in Europe are produced at St. Albans. So you can come in and see our beautiful facsimile of the St. Albans Psalter made for Christina of Marquiate. Beautiful document. Just gives you some idea of the quality of what was being produced. They were doing that. They were probably teaching, so taking in young postulants who were going to become monks and teaching and educating them. They operated, I suppose, for want of a better expression, a basic social services care for people. So if you did have an illness, the monastery was probably the place that you went. There was a basic form of medicine, often herbally based medicine, so clearly nothing like we would think of today, but you stood a chance of being treated at the monastery. Their prime purpose was prayer. We forget that. We think of them doing all these other things. Remember that they prayed 7 times a day, plus going to Mass. I think the analogy I would use is like a huge power station. In the Middle Ages, you prayed. You prayed to God. God was a given. Not everybody could take time out to pray because you were busy. You were trying to feed your children and till your fields and whatever else. But the monks were there to pray for you. So it was almost like they were praying on behalf of the country, on behalf of the nation. So I use the analogy of a power station, you know, this huge focus of prayer going up to God on behalf of everyone else. And lots of lay people, particularly the, I suppose, I don't like the word middle classes, but I think that's probably what they were, the beginning of the middle classes. They want to be associated with that prayer. And so the fraternity of St. Alban, today we have the Friends of the Abbey. The earliest form of that was the fraternity of St. Alban. Lots of lay people want to be associated with the Abbey, and they become members of this great fraternity. And the Abbey promises in turn to pray for them every day. So it becomes a relationship between these monks who are praying for the community and the communities supporting those monks.
Give us a picture of the buildings. We've built the church, the abbey.
Yes.
And there are certain scriptoriums within that abbey.
The scriptorium is probably on the south side because you wanted good light to do these manuscripts. Remember, people would be working by candlelight or daylight. And so the scriptorium was towards the south. In fact, virtually all the monastic buildings are to the south side anyway. But the scriptorium would have been positioned in an excellent area. We know that the cloister, and you can see the remains of the cloister arches on the side of the abbey building. Go and look at the cathedral today. There's a little sign explaining what you can see. The cloister was an open square, which was almost like a social hub. You could walk around the cloister. You could, as a monk, just be reciting your psalms. But you might also, during periods of conversation, walk companionably around the cloister having a chat with one of the other monks. We know that in the summer period, sometimes the scriptorium moved to the cloister. In the cloister, open to the sun, sunlight, bright sunlight, do your work in the cloister there. As I say, a large dormitory. Originally, all the monks slept in a dormitory as we think of today, a school dormitory. But eventually, little cubicles were introduced and each monk would have had their individual cubicle, which would have been very sparse, probably a pallet on the floor to sleep on, a bench and maybe a desk at which they could read or on which they could keep a prayer book or two. So a dormitory. The infirmary we've already mentioned. The chapter house, which was the business centre, so that's HQ. Chapter meeting. The abbot calls all his monks together and they sit and discuss. And
would that be a circular? Or?
Well, the one that you see today is built on the footprint of the medieval one. So the rounded end, the apsidal end, is still there in the modern chapter house today. The one at Westminster Abbey is, in fact, circular. And then, of course, a large refectory where people gathered for meals. And meals were sparse, usually only two meals a day. Meals were consumed in silence. So the monks did keep some of the day silent. And during meals, usually there were religious readings or improving readings read out by a monk, perhaps at a lectern, and everyone else carried on eating.
Then they'd be muttering, not vegetables again.
We think that some sign language, some very basic sign language, came from this period. If you come into the cathedral, we've actually illustrated some of them. We know that there were certain things you could do. So if you wanted somebody to pass you some bread, you made a circle using the thumb and index fingers of both hands. That was bread. If you wanted vegetable stew, you made the hand signals for cutting up vegetables. You're taking one hand and slicing it across the other hand as if you were cutting up vegetables, which meant pass the stew. And then, of course, just putting your finger in front of your lips if you wanted silence. And that one's remained with us today. So we do know monks had developed these little ways of communicating with each other. The greater silence happened after the last prayer of the day, Compline. And after Compline, a greater silence was kept all night long until the first prayers of the next morning. So it was important that, in a sense, there was a complete silence at certain times of the day and night.
You mentioned the gatehouse. What was that for?
Well, the gatehouse was built really originally as just a fortification for the abbey itself. You could argue that it's being built as a way to formally welcome grand people. So the abbot's lodging, where the abbot lived. Now, the abbot did not sleep in the dormitory. The abbot had his own house. The abbots were quite grand of St. Albans. And the abbot's house was not far from the gatehouse. So you can imagine the king turning up. The abbot goes and stands in the gateway to ceremonially greet the king. So building a huge, great gateway like that was, fortifying the abbey. But it was also a statement of status, to have a grand gateway in which the abbot could greet his important guests was something about the status of the abbey as well. And remember, that big gateway that we see today would have had walls on either side of it. You can still look at the side of the gateway, the one nearest the abbey, and you can see where the boundary wall fitted there. So the whole of the abbey enclosed by a boundary wall. That's a wall that is often assaulted by the townspeople when they don't like the abbey.
We talked earlier about it being sort of history seen from the men's side, as it always is, which is why it's called history. The nuns, did they have girls that they taught?
We know that they were involved, again, in social care. For example, leprosy or skin diseases. They may not be leprosy as we know it today, but certain skin diseases. Nuns often ran places to care for those, almost like, I suppose, a hospice in a modern way. away, where somebody went to die. So females were often, in this area anyway, associated with social care, but not everywhere. Sometimes females were very powerful people indeed in the orders. You think of St. Hilda up in Whitby. She wore a mitre like a male abbot. She was a very powerful woman. She ruled over a double house of male and female religious orders, but it wasn't a man running it, it was Hilda. I think she would have been a very powerful woman indeed. So there were these powerful women. There aren't great names that leap out in the monastic women of St. Albans. The real important female is Christina of Marquiate, but she's not originally a monastic. She is devoted to the abbot and the monks of St. Albans, walks in every day to say prayers with them, and eventually does found her own small religious community at Marquiate.
The powerful men, you've mentioned a few of them, like Abbot John, he was fairly late.
Yeah, John's in the 1400s.
When was the heyday? I mean, was this a very successful monastery that went on and on and on until something happened?
If you look in and make a judgment, most people say the 1100s and the 1200s are the real heyday in terms of power, prestige. If you look at the manuscripts that are produced, the ones that are produced in that era are regarded some of the finest. It may have been the heyday of pilgrimage. Pilgrimage never stopped. People coming to the shrine of St. Alban. It's really important. That's the other big thing they did. In addition to praying, they cared for and made available the shrine of Alban to pilgrims. So the huge flow of pilgrims brought wealth to the monastery, but also again brought attention and prestige. It looks as if in the early 1300s, when the Black Death starts to roll around England and the plague starts carrying people off. For example, we know that in 1349, almost exactly in the middle of the 1300s, Abbot Michael Mentmore and maybe 47 of the monks are carried off by the Black Death. That's quite a blow to a house which had only probably 100 monks. You're losing almost half of your establishment. And it never seems to quite recover after that. After the 1340s, it looks as if the abbey continues to be powerful, but it never quite gets back to its glory days.
Living in close proximity and with pilgrims coming from outside is a recipe for the spreading of disease, isn't it?
People didn't understand how the plague was spread, and so there was a fear that it was airborne. There is a tradition at St. Albans that says that that big, huge stone screen that chops up the nave of the abbey from the rest was built to stop the plague, you know, spreading into the monks. That may be true. There may be those people thinking we should enclose ourselves, and it may be that the monks withdrew somewhat from the population during that period. Because remember, other people could go and deal with the population. The monastery would have had a whole host of officials. You know, we often think of monks sitting up in the watching loft, watching the shrine, but that's not quite the right picture. The officials of the monastery and some of the freemen of the city or landowners in the city, they did their duties sitting up in the watching loft. It probably wasn't the monks. So there were others who could go out in the monks' place and deal with the pilgrims. The monks could withdraw slightly.
Well, we're going to look at the relationship perhaps between the church and the state next time in rather different sort of detail. We're going to focus on when the people rose up against.
Indeed, when all these objections to the monks and the abbot reached their peak.
Yes. Great. Thank you very much, David.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
And that brings our magazine programme to a close. Thanks to Goffby for our theme music, Briefly Encountered, to Alison for collecting all the wallets you return, and thanks to you for listening. We hope you enjoyed and maybe were informed by our selection today. And so I wish you a very pleasant summer, hopefully not too hot and not too wet, but bye for now.